This Texas Matters podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, behind a literary adventure into the Texas border's possible bizarro future, and a personal story of how Texas finally got real about child support. This is Texas Matters. From Texas Public Radio, I'm David Martin Davies. Some politicians paint a dire picture of the Texas-Mexico border, and it's natural to wonder where all of this is leading. The border is a place steeped in a real humanitarian crisis, an imperiled environmental quagmire, and inflamed rhetoric about walls. Fernando A. Flores imagines a life on the border in the near future in his novel Tears of the Truffle Pig. This border is a place where there has been a global food shortage, and the wealthy elite survive on what is known as filtering, a process by which vegetables and then animals are engineered, created for meat and fur. This is an imagined space where there are now two border walls and a third one is about to be built. Flores' protagonist must deal with these large issues while even as he mourns the deaths of his daughter and wife. Then a new threat emerges. Those with indigenous heritage could fall prey to a shrunken head industry. If that sounds absurd, that's because life is too. And what seems so surreal in the fictional town of MacArthur seems all too real with Fernando Flores as our guide through the Texas-Mexico border that simply isn't far off the beaten path. Texas Public Radio contributor Yvette Benavides interviewed Fernando A. Flores about his novel, Tears of the Truffle Pig.
So before we talk about the novel, I want to ask you about your life as a bookseller in Austin, because for me it seems like that is such a dream job. But at the same time, what is immersing yourself in books, as you've done, even when you were, I read you were working on the campus of the University of Pan Am and kind of hiding out in the library and doing a bunch of reading there. So what has that done for your writing life?
Well, I worked in the food industry for 9 years, almost a decade, and it allowed me to take a big leap and try and immerse my life in books. It allowed me also working out. So I got hired at Malvern Books in 2014. It allowed me to also see how the publishing industry worked. I really had no idea. I really had no idea anything about the publishing industry, about the differences between independent books, independent presses, big presses. And it allowed me to be oriented with what's in print and what is out there, you know, what is coming out all the time. It allows me to also visualize what's going on in literature, you know, how this big, huge beast that is literature is moving, slugging through time.
But one of the things I've realized about you just from my research is that you are extremely well-read. And so,
oh, thank you.
I mean, it's very impressive. I'm thinking about the ways in which you have had this exposure to the way publishing works and to sort of having maybe even being this barometer for what's out there and knowing where there are gaps or where the demand is. But at the same time, what was kind of unusual about your particular case that kind of flies in the face of what most people think about the publishing world is that you wrote this book really fast.
I did, yes.
So
in 3 months.
3 months, like that is really, really quick. And you also engaged sort of right off the bat with a publisher who was very interested in you, and you worked with the editor. But that's not a typical kind of story.
Yeah, definitely. At the time when I wrote this, I wrote the whole thing just in 3 months, and from October 2014 to January 2015, and I typed the whole thing on an Olivetti Underwood Letter at 32, a typewriter. Really, at the time, I also didn't know how to publish a book. After I typed the whole thing out, I put it into the computer. I started looking for an agent, and that took like a long time. That took like a year. And then it took another year and a half of doing a few revisions, a few drafts of it, of working on it. And then through a series of extremely fortunate events, I found its way to MCD FSG Original, who are my publishers.
But what was that process like? I mean, you must have just been completely immersed, obsessed with the
book. Definitely. I had never in my life been given the opportunity of time to work on projects. In my life, when I moved to Austin, Texas in 2005, I did so knowing that I had no interest in getting a car or getting a job that will pay well. My interest was just to survive however I could so that I could write and read as much as possible. So I lived my life very minimalistically. After doing that for such a long time, and I won an award in the summer of 2014 by the Alfredo Cisneros del Moral Foundation, I lost my job within a week also of getting that award. I got laid off, and I got hired at the bookstore all within 10 days. But I got hired at the bookstore to work only 2 days a week. So out of convenience, I was like, okay, I was given a little bit of prize money. It's now or never. This prize money is going to run out one day. I'm going to have to get either another job or work longer hours at the bookstore. So here it is, now or never. So my driving force primarily was the fear of running both out of time and out of money.
Wow, and this was the book. Like, this was the book that was on the line for you, right?
This is the book. So in that time, I said to myself, look, I'm either going to revise old projects, go through old projects, and try to make a book out of them, or I'm going to do something completely new and different that I've never done before. So to me, that was more enticing to go towards the unknown.
And how did you come upon this particular idea? Or maybe can you give us just the briefest, spoiler-free synopsis of the book for those who haven't read it?
Yes, Tears of the Truffle Pig takes place like in an alternate South Texas with two border walls and a controversial third border wall about to be erected. And it's about a widower looking for his brother who got kidnapped by a headhunting syndicate, which is syndicates that find people and they cut their heads off and shrink their heads and sell them in the underground art market. And the darker your skin is, the more your head is worth. It takes place also years after this worldwide food shortage that kind of inspired these scientists to create this technology where in these troughs they grow crops and food in a rapid manner. In an accelerated manner, and eventually it evolves into growing farm animals. And also in this world, drugs have been legalized. So all the syndicates that would move drugs along the border and no longer had a profession kind of hijacked this technology, this filtering technology of bringing crops and animal back to life. And in the background of all this is the indigenous people of South Texas, the Araña people, and the myth that comes along with them. They, like 500 years before our narrative starts, they had disappeared mysteriously, but also 50 years prior where our narrative starts, they somehow started returning to South Texas. And people are remembering their myth and this creature they worship, which is the truffle pig, which is, if you can imagine, like a pig with reptilian skin and hooves like a deer and a beak like an eagle. And there's myths about this truffle pig having magical characteristics. So along all this, the syndicates fighting for power down in South Texas, a rising syndicate that's rising into power steals 13 of the Olmec heads in Mexico overnight to sell at an underground art auction. So all these things are spinning around throughout this narrative.
There's so many things, but you do such a good job of keeping the story very clear for us. I mean, and this novel has these layers. I guess I'm going to call it surrealism. And there's this kind of rough-hewn dystopian landscape as the backdrop for every other strange element in the story that's just a little bit, I'll just say it again, it's a little bit surreal.
Definitely.
And yet it's grounded in this verisimilitude and these realities about the border and about people and about myths and culture and our obsession with food and the threat of starvation. I mean, there's so many elements that are so interesting. But I want to ask you about that surrealism, because sometimes readers are turned off by the idea. They just want a kind of a straight up story. They don't see surrealism or these kinds of fantastical elements as useful for a story. But what do you see as the importance of these elements? What do they help you do in telling a story?
Yes, it's very interesting to me, because in our history of literature, you know, this idea of what we call realism is really only like 500 years old. It's still very much a modern concept in our evolution. And the oldest stories that anybody has, that we all have collectively as a people, are fantastical stories. The oldest stories that existed in the Americas or here in Texas before 1492 were all fantastical stories. Just because nobody wrote them down does not make them any less real or present in this land. So I was very much interested in trying to access some of that lost mythology that we have, that and that I believe we're all surrounded with. But because of this, I don't know, maybe a cultural Western concept of what literature is, you know, which is people see it as the reflection of our everyday lives. But to me, that is like saying an imitation of something is more valuable than something that is complete, that is imagined from the ground up.
This book, which you started in 2014, actually addresses a number of the subjects that we're dealing with today. I mean, in ways that are pretty prophetic. So even if you're not intending to be political or making political statements,
yes,
it's prophetic in ways that I think can come from someone who spent a lot of time on the border, and also from someone who's removed from it and can develop a pretty clear-eyed perspective about it. I mean, most of us from the border, I think, live with the fear of the promise of the nightmarish realities that we're living in right now, about border walls and militarized spaces and living under the thumb of corrupt political machines. But did you have in mind when you started the book that this is where we were headed in 2019?
I don't think I had any way of knowing, to be honest. I will say this, that when I put the two border walls in the book, and with the third border wall coming up, I knew immediately any society that is absurd enough to build one border wall will build another one after that, and because it's not going to work. And then after that, they'll build another one because it's not going to work. And then they'll remember how good a time they had putting up a wall. So people say you build that wall, you know, build five walls. None of them are going to work. So to me, something that I appreciate about writing, about literature, trying to write a story, I try to give myself as much silence as possible. It takes me a long time to try to access, I guess, what I see as the unknown. To me, writing the story, you know, came from an unknown place. It was written so fast because of things that I was afraid would leave me if I didn't do it too fast. So also, I was really influenced by the idea of working at a bookstore. There's this tiny book that this press called New Directions. This is the oldest independent press in the United States. It's been around since 1936. They put out a little pamphlet of the Book of Revelation by John of Patmos. And I asked myself, how do you write a prophecy? You know, how do you just sit down and write a prophecy? And the obvious answer was like, well, you know, you sit down, you start writing it, and then you keep doing it until you finish.
That's one way.
That's the way to do it. So to me, that's how I remembered. That's what I try to remember. I'm like, all right, I have to write this book. And how do you write a book? Well, you sit down and you do it until you finish.
Fernando A. Flores is the author of Tears of the Truffle Pig. It's published by MCD and FSG Originals. As the Texas legislature winds down its session, there's bound to be disappointments on both sides. Only so many bills can get passed, and not everyone's going to like the ones that do. Good bills will die. And we're going to hear the story about a bill that died over and over again at the Capitol. It took decades to finally pass a law that got real with child support in Texas. And that happened with the critical help of an Austin woman who experienced firsthand why this law was needed. KUT's Matt Largy has the story.
Susan Morrison was 2 years old when her dad left.
I knew that he existed because we would get Christmas cards signed Daddy, but we didn't know where he was.
Susan was in San Angelo with her mom, Eleanor, and her brother and sister. Susan was the youngest.
Well, I think there was a longing for him, and we would write letters and send him to an address he was supposed to be living, but we would not get any response to our letters.
Her mom worked hard to keep things together. She had a job at the Air Force Base in San Angelo.
And she was the only college-educated person in that office. And yet she was paid a little bit above minimum wage.
So it was financially, it was tough for you guys.
She lived paycheck to paycheck.
It wasn't until Susan was about 10 that she found out her dad wasn't paying child support. When she asked her mom if she could go to a summer camp.
My mom never said anything derogatory about my father. She didn't want us to have any negative feelings about him. So when she had to say that we couldn't afford it, you know, we asked why. And so she thought at that point we were old enough to know.
Did you blame him at all? Were you angry about it?
Well, maybe. I think I was mostly confused because I thought, we have laws in America. Why are the laws not making him pay?
Now, see, here's a funny thing about Texas. At this point, around 1970, all but a few states allowed court-ordered child support to be taken directly out of someone's paycheck. But not Texas.
Because our state was settled by a lot of debtors that were fleeing from creditors. They wanted to make sure that under no circumstances would anybody's paycheck ever be garnished or money taken out involuntarily.
So they put a ban on any kind of wage garnishing in the state constitution. It's not like no one ever tried to change it. Various lawmakers had tried for years to pass a constitutional amendment to allow garnishing wages for child support, but they all failed. Susan went to college in the late 70s. By that time, non-payment of child support was a huge problem in Texas. 70% of parents who were supposed to pay child support were not. So when did your interest in the child support law start?
That started with my job at the Capitol. I was working for the Speaker of the House doing the postings for committee meetings.
This was in 1979. She saw there was a hearing for a bill on child support enforcement. She knew what she had to do.
So I went to that hearing on that bill, and I decided to just stand up and testify and tell my story, my family's story.
What did you say when you got up there for the first time?
That my mother was a single mom raising three kids on her own, and that my father was retired military, but he wasn't paying child support. And that it was harmful to families. At that point, my mother had suffered breast cancer. So I think I was doing it for my mom.
Do you remember what the reaction was when you told your story?
Everybody was interested in the room, but it still didn't pass. And so at that point, I said to myself, if it takes my whole life, I'm going to make sure this is done.
Susan headed back to college at UT the next semester. She was taking a class called Legislative Process.
And our job was to pick some legislation that we wanted to see through with our own class voting on it.
She knew exactly which bill to pick, a constitutional amendment to allow garnishing wages for child support.
I was surprised that my professor didn't really want me to focus on that bill because she said it had never passed in her class.
Just like the real legislature, the child support bill never went anywhere. But Susan kept going.
And what I did was build coalitions with like-minded people, and I supported their legislation if it was good, and they supported mine.
Her strategy worked. She rounded up enough votes, and the class passed her bill.
I think that gave me courage to go ahead and work on getting it passed for real.
Susan knew the bill had failed every time it was brought up since 1961. She knew she needed help. She had a friend who worked for Ray Farabee. He was an influential state senator from Wichita Falls. In 1983, Farabee agreed to sponsor the constitutional amendment.
Originally, it was seen as something liberal because it was taking the freedom away from an earner's control over their paycheck. The way Senator Farabee got the more conservative senators on board was to show how fiscally responsible it was.
Basically, Farabee argued that many families were on welfare because one parent wasn't paying child support. Then there was the outside support.
I think by the time the 80s came around, there were enough women in labor unions that were dues-paying members, and probably either they owed child support or they were owed child support, that they were in favor of it, so there wasn't the big push against it this time.
Opposition essentially vanished. Approval in the legislature was nearly unanimous.
Final passage. Secretary, read the caption.
House Joint Resolution 1, amending the Constitution to allow for the assignment of income.
Questions on final passage. Secretary, call the roll.
Blake. Brooks,
it was just really the time, I think. It was finally time for it.
Being 27 ayes and 3 noes, House Joint Resolution 1 is finally passed.
Like all state constitutional amendments, it had to be approved by voters. And it was, by a huge margin, in November 1983. Susan called her mom the next day to tell her the news.
Do you remember what you said to her or what she said to you?
She was just so proud. And relieved.
I think.
That it was going to help so many women.
Did you tell her that she was the inspiration for you doing this?
Oh, she knew.
Yeah.
Yeah. We both were very happy. And she lived 3 more months.
While all this was going on, something else was happening too.
When my dad heard it was going to happen, he got back in touch with us. And it was only the third time we had seen him in my life. And he showed up and said, I want to pay at least some of the money I owe your mom.
The kids weren't kids anymore, but he offered to pay half of what he owed. About $30,000. Susan's mom said yes, the money would be helpful while she was fighting cancer.
It started a relationship where he would come and visit, and he invited us to come visit him.
Her dad, Herbert, lived in New Mexico. His second wife had died. He never had more kids, and he'd recently had a heart attack. Susan guesses he saw his time to get to know his kids was getting short.
Was he supportive of what you were doing with the child support law?
We never really talked about it, other than him saying, I want to pay, will she take half?
So he was obviously aware of it, but you never talked about it.
Right.
He'd write letters. Susan and her siblings would go to reunions with their dad's family, but there was a distance. In 1991, Herbert was diagnosed with prostate cancer. It had moved into his bones. He had 6 months to live. He had a big request for Susan, move to New Mexico to take care of him. She told him she couldn't give up that much.
But I am willing to rent a house, build a ramp, so that when it comes time that you aren't able to walk with a cane, that you can get in and out.
So he moved to Austin, living in the same house with Susan for the first time since she was 2 years old.
It was like living with a stranger, but it was worth it because the hospice people helped me get comfortable with him.
Family and old friends came to visit. She learned about his childhood on the family farm during the Depression, about his time in the Air Force during World War II, his year as a prisoner of war in Germany.
Did you sympathize with your dad after that? I mean, like, learning all the things that he went through, did that change how you felt about, you know, what he did to you and your mom?
Well, I don't really think it excused him, but I think the deprivation made him feel like it just wasn't enough to to be a family man. He told me when he was living with me that my dad said, "You know, I always loved you." It's like, no, not really. He said, "If I had it to do over, I wouldn't have left my family." So there was a little bit of apology there. But he always had the power to return. For whatever reasons, he didn't.
Susan cared for Herbert for about 7 months before he was too sick to be at home. She was out of town the weekend he died.
My uncle was with him. He said he took him for pie, and he ate his pie and I guess had a heart attack and passed away. So they called me. I immediately, you know, rushed back to town and sort of said goodbye to him. I think it was his sort of military formalities at the funeral that was the real closure that I felt. Not so much him being gone physically as that experience of the soldiers coming and giving my brother the flag, that was the finality of it.
In the end, Susan says she's forgiven her dad. She's at peace with his absence.
I guess looking back at the age of 61, I try to live my life being grateful, because if there had been anything that ever happened to my mother, I don't know what would have happened to us, because he wasn't available. We were so lucky that even though she got cancer, she survived 10 years and she kept working. One reason I went to law school was to take care of her. I didn't get to do much of that. And I know she would have been glad that I took care of my dad, because that's how she raised us.
When it comes to child support and what Susan did to help change the law about enforcement, she knows the system isn't perfect. There are still lots of kids in Texas who aren't getting the financial support they deserve from one of their parents. But Susan hopes it's helping at least some kids have a more secure childhood than she did.
There's nothing better than a child feeling like both parents care. So that's what I'm hoping that child support enforcement across the state does, is communicate that to the kids.
Matt Largy, KUT News.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can listen to past Texas Matters episodes, and you can find us wherever you download those podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.